Hello, Capital Region. This is the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOC 105.3 FM Troy, New York, and WOOS 98.9 FM Schenectady, broadcasting live from the Sanctuary for Independent Media. I'm your host, H. Bosch Jr.
And I'm Michelle. Let's start with some headlines.
Okay. All right. On a largely party line, the House of Representatives impeached Donald Trump for abuse of power, obstruction of Congress, making him the third president in the history to be charged with committing high crimes and misdemeanors in face removal by the Senate. Yeah, good luck with that. No one Republican in the country voted to hold Trump accountable for his actions.
AP reports that the state of New York would not issue violations against certain water suppliers who notify the public that they have too high levels of certain industrial synthetic chemicals. Water systems could apply for a 24-month deferral as they install new water treatment systems. Water suppliers concerned about insurance liability have said they will have to shut off wells to avoid providing consumers with contaminated water.
Okay. In a split decision, a federal appeals court ruled that the individual insurance mandate under Obamacare is unconstitutional while leaving the rest of the law intact for the time being while they are reviewed. The court based its ruling on the vote by Congress in 2017 to reduce the tax on people without insurance to zero.
State judges in New York won't be getting a pay raise next year or for the following 3 years after members of a panel created by the legislature to evaluate such an increase declined to grant one Wednesday, citing the state's looming $6.1 billion budget deficit. State lawmakers also will not immediately get year two of their 3-year pay raise due to pending litigation.
All right. With an unhoused population of more than 7,000, or 70,000, of which 60,000 live in shelters, NYC Mayor de Blasio is trying to get 3,600 unhoused people living in the street into shelters and homes. His new plan includes adding 1,000 safe haven beds and 1,000 apartments in 5 years. According to the Times Union, de Blasio did not provide a dollar figure for the cost. If the 5-year plan, they are about 5,200 unhoused in the capital region, of which over 1,300 of, or 26%, are children, as reported by the News 10.
For those of you just tuning in, you're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOC 105.3 FM Troy, WOOS 98.9 FM Schenectady, WOOA 106.9 FM Albany, and WCAA 107.3 FM Albany.
To learn more about the program and how to support the Sanctuary for Independent Media, visit us online at mediasanctuary.org. If you have comments, suggestions, or warm regards, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org or follow us on Instagram, Twitter at Media Sanctuary, and on Facebook at facebook.com/Media Sanctuary. All right, in segment one, opening, more than a dozen communities in the Capital District have agreed to join together in community choice aggregation to purchase electricity together for local residents with a focus on lower cost and 100% renewable. We talked with organizer Jeff Corbin of Union College with Mark Dunley for Hudson Mohawk Magazine.
We're joined by Jeff Corbin, who is a professor at Union College. Jeff has been on at least once before to talk about this idea of setting up a Capital District community choice aggregation to buy electricity cooperatively to hopefully both lower cost but also get 100% renewables. So we thought we'd have Jeff to come back on just to give us a little bit update, maybe start off with a quick explanation of what a CCA is, and then we'll move on to what progress has been made recently. So, Jeff, what's a CCA?
Yeah. So Community Choice Aggregation is a program that's approved by the State Public Services Commission where municipalities can band together and they can get favorable electricity rates and choice over the sources of where that electricity is generated for their residents in the city. And like a buyer's club like BJ's or a co-op or something like that, if you have a lot of customers, then you have clout on the marketplace. And so unlike an individual customer of National Grid, an aggregation can get better prices and be able to actually decide where the energy comes from. So that's the idea of a community choice aggregation or a CCA.
And, you know, so this is not a new thing in New York. It has been tried elsewhere in the state, but this is the big effort here in the Capital District?
Yep. The pilot for CCA in New York State was in Westchester County, and there are now several others that are online or just about to come online. The Capital District CCA, which we expect to see up and running in 2020, will not be the largest, but it will be the one that has the most diverse population as far as cities with a wide range of socioeconomic backgrounds and so forth.
Now, I think the last time we had you on, along with Tina Lieberman, it just got to the point where three of the suburban municipalities in Albany County had agreed to move forward, hire what's called a CCA administrator. But since then, actually, I guess is actually more than a dozen communities have now joined or indicated
That's
they're
right.
willing to support it.
I think those first counties, first cities, Bethlehem, New Scotland, really taking the lead there. Once they made a decision to join an aggregation and they chose Mega, one of the administrators that is approved to really run to be the administrator for CCAs in New York State. Once that happened, then really the dominoes started to fall and we started getting many more municipalities, small ones at the beginning, like Niskayuna, and some others of that size, and then Saratoga Springs. And what's really exciting now is that we've added now Troy and Albany and Schenectady. So all told, we have, like you say, over a dozen. I think we're at 16 right now, although that number may be even a little bit higher with towns, villages, and then these big cities that we have in the capital region to the tune now of 90,000 households. Actual metered households that are now signed up.
Now, this almost sounds too good to be true. We're going to get to purchase 100% clean and renewable energy if that's what we want, and we still have a good chance of lowering our electric bills. How can that possibly work?
And that was exactly when I first heard about this. That was exactly, I kept waiting for the catch. I kept thinking this is too good to be true, And so what's the catch? Well, the fact is that we're going to be able to see what the market can give to us. And there are many hydroelectric facilities and even solar and wind providers that are looking for good, stable customer bases, and they're willing to give bargains for a large, stable contract that's going to last for 18 months or 2 years. So what we're going to be able to do is to set the parameters for what we want. We want at or close to or at 100% clean energy. What price can you give us? And then each city will be able to look and see and confirm that price is going to be below what the recent historical rates have been for National Grid. And if it's favorable, if it is, no more expensive and hopefully even cheaper than what we currently pay for relatively dirty fossil fuel energy that most of us get from National Grid, then we'll be able to sign those contracts. And at that point, we will be getting our energy from these clean sources and we'll have a nice stable price that'll be protected from those price spikes that happen in the summertime when we're all using our air conditioning on a hot day and all of a sudden the electricity prices spike.
So I wake up in the middle of the night and I see a tree has fallen down and knocked over the power line and you know, VCR is not getting any power. Do I call you up or the CCA? Who comes out and fix this thing?
Well, so the way that our deregulated energy system works now is that National Grid, with the trucks and all that, basically all they are is they operate the lines. They make sure that the power stays on, that when I turn on the light, that it comes on, and then if a tree falls, then they come out and they fix it. The CCA is really a matter of, where does my bill go? Where does the money in my, when I pay my bill, wind up going? It doesn't change who delivers my electricity. That's still National Grid. It doesn't affect the reliability. That's still the independent system operator in National Grid. So as far as, are my lights going to turn on? Is somebody going to come and fix that wire when the tree falls on it? That's not going to change. So really, the day-to-day way that we interact with our power, thankfully, we don't think about it unless we're paying our bill, that's not going to change. And what does change is who our money is going to. It's going to go to green suppliers, and it's going to encourage the generation of more green energy in the future.
Now, say I'm an individual residential customer in, you know, Troy, and for whatever reason, I just don't like this, and I don't want to participate. Do I have the option of getting out of it?
You do, and I think that's a really good, you know, it's important for everybody to be able to have the choice of what they're going to do. CCA is only increasing the choices that customers have. Customers can opt out before or even after the CCA contracts are signed and basically say, nope, I want to stick with National Grid or whatever other supplier that I might have that I've signed up with. Residents who have not chosen a third-party supplier besides National Grid will be automatically opted into our CCA, but there will be an extensive multi-month education campaign letting people know what's coming and letting them understand what's going to change. And anybody who doesn't want to do it will be able to say, no thanks, I just want to stay with National Grid. And if any point during the contract, if they decide that they're not happy with it for any reason, then they can, again, simply call up, fill out a quick form, and they'll be able to be switched back to National Grid.
So we have about 90 seconds left. We're talking with Jeff Corbin, a professor at Union College, about the Capital District getting community choice aggregation. What can people do at this point if they think there's a good idea? Is this a done deal? Is there anything that still needs to be done to make this happen?
Well, the cities that I mentioned earlier have really already done most of the legwork in order to be able to join this aggregation. But it is worth, one, find out if your city is a member of it. And we do have a Facebook page, Capital District Community Energy, that you can log on to in order to get more information. We can help you find out if your municipality is a member. If it is, then it's, well, if your city or town is not a member, then you should ask your elected officials to join. If you've already joined, if you live in Albany, if you live in Niskayuna, New Scotland, Bethlehem, then it's still worth letting your representatives know that you're in favor of this and you want to have as close to 100% clean energy as possible in these contracts. There are still some decisions that are going to be made in coming months, but the more that we can do in order to let our representatives know that we value clean energy, the better.
Thank you very much, Jeff. We've been talking about community choice aggregation. This is Mark Dunley.
That was Jeff Corbin of Union College speaking with WOOC correspondent Mark Dunley about 12 communities grouping together to purchase electricity for their local residents.
Okay, in our next segment, all right, yours truly, H. Bosch Jr. and his Triple E segment, interviews my good friend and a friend of the station, Ms. Sheena Goodheim, author, playwright, and motivational speaker about her best-selling book. Hello, hello, hello.
Well, how are you?
I'm doing well, thank you, and happy holidays to you and the family.
Yes, definitely happy holidays.
Yes. So let's dig right in. what to look for or look out for in the year of 2020?
Well, definitely in 2020, I'm shaking and moving. I have my book signing for Barnes & Noble February 1st, and I've been booked for Philly, Atlantic City, and North Carolina so far.
Bless your heart twice. Wow. So are you working on book two? And if so, what is it going to be, or how is it going to be different?
I'm working on book two. With this book, it's going to be a little bit more detailed and actually a little bit of information about me.
Okay. So how are you going to, or are you going to be traveling? Because I see you all over the place.
Yeah, yeah. I'm definitely trying to travel more. It's in the cards. The Lord got it, and I'm claiming it.
Well, if he got it, you claim it. It's yours.
Yes. Yeah.
Have you thought about doing any workshops for the coming year? And if so, you know right here, yours truly is on board, you know?
Yes, I'm definitely looking to do some workshops about, you know, writing books and also just getting people in the mindset of taking down their masks and unveiling themselves.
Great. Have you thought about starting a group?
I have. I'm still contemplating on how I'm going to shake and move that, but I have. I definitely wouldn't mind starting a domestic violence group and actually an empowerment group.
Great, great. I think you are a living testament to that, and how you share your story, it will empower so many people and bring them out of the closet to talk about their story. So what are your goals for the coming year?
My goals for the coming year is definitely to skyrocket and, you know, empower and motivate,
network
and all the et ceteras, you know, just shake and move and hit all these different states and just bring out the things that people are afraid to talk about with themselves.
Uh-huh. And I love this. You know, this was one of my favorite questions when I was putting things together, because, you know, I gave you that nickname, right? Yours truly. So what has changed about the lady behind the mask?
I definitely embrace my name that you gave me.
Oh, well, thank you so much.
And, you know, I'm definitely stepping out my box. I'm stepping out my comfort zone and not just sticking to certain things. I've definitely just unveiled the mask and I'm doing it a whole lot more.
Mm-hmm. If there could be anything you can change, what would it be?
That is definitely a good question. Honestly, if I change anything, I think it would just be about me not being afraid to speak out a lot more.
Mm-hmm.
You know, definitely stepping into a different platforms.
Okay, yep, a different arena.
Yes.
Right, a different theater, so to speak. So if you haven't, you need to, and that is, have you ever thought about traveling overseas? Because there's a market waiting for the lady behind the mask.
You know, it's a thought, because actually my book is over there in London. So
really?
Yeah, it is. It's
wow,
out in the UK.
Way. And I'm going to London and Paris in July.
You taking me?
For my
me?
Birthday. You know, you guys, did you tell her? How did she find that out? My goodness. Goodness. I thought that was a surprise, you know? So, what's some important facts about the lady behind the mask?
Definitely, she's very determined. She's a hard worker. She is a go-getter. She's one of those ones that I am going for everything, whatever's in the way. I'm moving it out the way and being determined about it.
Great, great. So who in your eyes paved the way for you to speak about your truth?
I would say my mom. She taught me how to be a very strong individual and not to shy away from things.
How about that? Anyone you want to give a shout out and tell people how they can reach out and get involved with your movement?
Okay, definitely I want to shout out my team, CEO. I want to also shout out all my friends that work with the Sheena and Master Motivation, my kids, Liana and Samira, and all my friends that support me and behind my vision. And how you contact me is definitely Sheena and Master Motivation on Facebook, my Sheena author page. You can hit me up on Instagram at Testimony for Life. You can also find me at 518-930-6313 is my telephone number, and my email is Escadine, which is spelled Sgourdine 16 at gmail.com.
How about that? Well, you know, what I like about us is when you come on, you always are good and right to the point. And I like to say, nice guys finish fast, not last. So
definitely.
I thank you for what you've done. I thank you for what you're doing. And I thank you for what you continue to do. You are definitely a true, true difference maker. We appreciate you.
And I appreciate y'all.
All right. Well, thank you so much. All right. So for those of you, all right. No, I'm going to let my co-host close it out.
Mm-hmm. That was WOOC correspondent H. Botch Jr. with Triple E segment interviewing Sheena Goodine, local author, playwright, and motivational speaker.
How about that? She is just a wonderful, wonderful soul and a kindred spirit, and I wish her nothing but God's continued grace and mercy and favor. We are blessed to have her part of the Capital Region. So, for those of you tuning in, I'm H. Bosch Jr.
And I'm Michelle. You're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network.
To learn more about the Hudson Mohawk Magazine program, to listen online, and to learn how to support the Sanctuary for Independent Media, check us out online at mediasanctuary.org. If you have comments, suggestions, or a sour bone to pick, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org. All right, in segment number three, HMM correspondent Spencer Keeble speaks with Dan Shapley, Walter Quality, on Water Quality Program, Director of Riverkeeper, on recent legislative actions at the Hudson Mohawk River water quality issues.
Hi, I'm here with Dan Shapley here at the Sanctuary for Independent Media for the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. And Dan is the Water Quality Program Director of Riverkeeper. Riverkeeper and Dan were just here at the Sanctuary on November 1st to launch their short film, A Living River, and celebrate the end of their sampling season. Dan spoke with the audience after the film was shown about many of the issues that they are concerned with. Dan, what is Riverkeeper?
Oh, thanks, Spencer. Riverkeeper, we're a 50-plus-year-old environmental organization, and our mission is to protect and restore the Hudson River, its tributaries, and the drinking water supplies that rely on those waters. We do that with a combination of tactics. We have a legal team, and it's been a kind of bedrock of the organization for our history to use the laws that are available for citizens to enforce, to protect and restore water quality. And we also have a patrol boat on the water. Captain John Lipscomb takes that boat from New York Harbor all the way up to Troy. That's the tidal portion of the estuary. Goes out as far as Rome on the Mohawk River and up to Fort Edward on the Upper Hudson. And that's to be the eyes and the ears and the voice for the water from the perspective of the water, to get people out and really see and experience what's going on. And then the last part of our organization is the community science. And that's the part of the organization that I work on. So we get people engaged with measuring water quality in the creeks that flow into the Hudson and in the Hudson itself, and use that information as well as the kind of collection of people and the organized the work to organize them to advocate for improved water quality and other issues that are of importance to that group of people who come out and do that work.
Okay, so some of those important issues. You said this year was a landmark year for some legislation. Do you want to speak on that?
Yeah, so we were really, very happy with the Democrats kind of taking over both houses of the legislature. A lot happened in New York, kind of unstuck a lot of things that had been waiting. So we saw landmark climate legislation, a ban on plastic bags, money put into the Clean Water Infrastructure Act, and there were just grants announced today and yesterday that really are focused on improving water quality by improving our pipes, our treatment plants, and things like that. We saw a ban on a toxic pesticide. So a lot of, just tick down the list, just a lot of actions that are really important that'll have some impact over many years to help protect and restore water. But one thing that your listeners could do to help is there's one bill that has been lingering on the governor's desk and it's waiting for a signature, and it would start to ban the use of certain toxic chemicals in firefighting foams. And these chemicals are called PFAS chemicals, PFAS, and they are highly soluble in water. They are called forever chemicals because they just don't go away. And they're highly toxic, many of them that have been studied. And as we study more of them, we find more of them are toxic. So they're basically a perfect water contaminant, unfortunately. And they've contaminated drinking water supplies. These are the family of chemicals affecting Hoosick Falls and Newburgh. So we're looking for that signature on that bill. And people can help by going to riverkeeper.org. And going to the Action Center and sending a message to the governor now, make sure that bill gets signed before the end of this calendar year.
Yeah, I noticed that your online resource makes it really easy to send a really coherent letter to elected officials.
Yeah, we really try to time those too and make sure that they're going to have impact. You know, we don't ask people to take an action if it's not really targeted and strategic. It's not just signing a petition. It's really, you know, something that we feel it can affect change. And we love it to get people involved that way. It's just basic civics, right? This is how our government works. But often that, you know, we play the role of understanding what needs to be done and just being able to communicate to people who care how to take that action. So it's a great place to go to keep up on that. And you can sign up for our emails and get regular updates for how to take those kinds of actions.
So is that at riverkeeper.com?
Riverkeeper.org.
.org. Yeah. So you guys look after the Mohawk and the Hudson. What are some issues with the Hudson that you're looking at this year, this coming year?
Well, one of the things we've been working on the last several years is to organize the communities that draw drinking water from the Hudson River, and that's Poughkeepsie, Rhinebeck, Highland, Hyde Park, Port Ewan, and a lot of people, especially as I get into the Capital District and I'm talking to groups, a lot of people are really surprised and shocked to learn that the Hudson River is a drinking water source, because we just don't think of it as we're standing on the banks of the river in Troy or Albany. But 100,000 people rely on the Hudson River for drinking water. So we've been working with the communities that call themselves the Hudson Seven, because there's seven municipalities in all that rely on the Hudson River for drinking water. So we're working with them on a number of issues to try and help them protect that source of their drinking water and to get the resources they need to do that. A couple things that are kind of high on the list right now are making sure that a coal tar cleanup that's happening in Poughkeepsie is done in a way that will not imperil the drinking water intakes that are relatively nearby, and also to try to engage the Coast Guard and the EPA in really developing more robust plans to prevent spill from any of the tankers that are using the Hudson as a as a highway. That if there's ever to prevent the spill is obviously the number one goal, because any spill, a dirty little secret about oil spills particularly, is that once there's a spill in water, there's really very little recovered. You see the response and the booms put out in the water and all of the activity to supposedly kind of collect the oil, but once it's there, it's there. So we really want to prevent the spill and make sure that if there is a spill, that we have a really good, robust response ready, because right now it's a real gap. So those are a couple things for the Hudson River and the drinking water that we're really focused on.
Oh, that's great. So is there any issues with the Mohawk that have been going on recently?
Yeah, well, equally as surprising to a lot of people is the Mohawk River is also a source of drinking water for also about 100,000 people in Colony and the city of Cohoes. That's directly the drinking water source. And the village of Green Island also uses it as a backup source. And there are a number of communities that rely on the aquifer that's really integral with the river. As you get out to Schenectady and Glenville, Rotterdam, Niskayuna, Scotia, that area, there's a lot of groundwater. So we're sort of in an earlier phase of just trying to educate people that the river is important for a lot of reasons. And one of them is that it's the drinking water supply. And really just put that on the radar for people so they understand how important those streams running through their communities are that are going into the Mohawk River. If they're not clean, the river's not clean. We have to really focus on the protection of the river for that purpose. And right now we're trying to work with New York Power Authority, which operates two hydroelectric facilities on two dams on the Mohawk River, because they are seeking to relicense those facilities. They need a federal license. Part of that license requires them to study the environmental impacts of having dams and hydro facilities in the river. And people don't always appreciate, but dams have a profound and really profoundly negative effect on rivers. They turn rivers into lakes. So that free-flowing river is changed utterly when there's a dam in it. The other thing they can do is really affect water quality for places like the Mohawk, that is a drinking water supply. Because in the Mohawk, we have a lot of wastewater discharges and runoff from agriculture. And even when those wastewater discharges are treated, there's a lot of nutrients. And nutrients are a good thing in small amount, but in large amount, they can lead to algal blooms. And dams really, you know, create the conditions that make algal blooms more likely. They allow that the water slows down, it pools up, the pollutants can kind of concentrate. So algal bloom in a drinking water supply can lead to water quality problems. It can lead to disinfection byproducts, which are a regulated contaminant, and there is the potential for a harmful algal bloom, which we've been having much more frequently across our whole state. And we will see these in ever-increasing number as climate change takes its toll, because temperature is a key ingredient. So we really want to make sure, as these dams are relicensed, that they study the key variables of water quality that are important to those drinking water supplies. And we're butting heads a little bit with NIPA right now, and we have a comment deadline staring us down on December 22nd. The public can weigh in, and if you want to, there's a website that NIPA has at New York Power Authority for the Vischer Ferry and Crescent Dam. It'll show you how to comment. And the important thing is to tell them, study chlorophyll and nutrients, because those are two key variables for the drinking water supply. And we really want to see make sure that those are fully considered as the dams are relicensed.
Well, that's great. Dan, thank you for coming on the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. I hope to come back. I really enjoyed it. Thank you.
That was Dan Shipley, Water Quality Program Director of Riverkeeper, speaking on Hudson and Mohawk River water quality issues with HMM correspondent Spencer Keeble.
Okay, in segment four, the Hudson Mohawk Magazine Network roaming labor correspondent and my very, very good friend, Mr. Willie Terry, attended the celebratory historic pre-trial reform rally in Troy on December 10th. The new legislation will go into effect on January 1, 2020. In this segment, you will hear various community activists giving their thoughts on the new reform law at the rally that they held in front of Rensselaer County Courthouse in Troy, New York.
Now!
What do we want?
Justice!
When do we want it?
Now!
Keep it moving because it's cold. Melanie Trimble from the New York Civil Liberties Union of the Capital District.
Woo!
All right, Melanie.
The historic criminal justice reforms that will take place on January 1st finally acknowledge that money bail is corrupt, inequitable, and unfair. In addition, the reforms acknowledge that court practices that allow prosecutors to keep basic information about their cases from defendants is inherently unjust. When it comes to bail, the size of people's wallets shouldn't determine whether they can await their court date at home or stay locked up in jail. Those who are rich should not be the only ones to be presumed innocent before trial.
That's right.
On January 1st, we should see a significantly reduced reliance on money to determine a person's liberty. Opponents of these reforms have stoked unnecessary fears by suggesting that we must detain people based on an inability to pay bail in order to keep people safe. This is not a form of justice, nor is it a pathway to safety. Rather, this only placed our human rights, and civil liberties more in jeopardy, not to mention people's lives. Listing the charges that will no longer qualify for cash bail to scare people is deceptive, because it suggests that people charged with the offenses are not being released today. To be clear, under current bail law, anyone charged with such offenses are already going home if they're rich enough to afford bail. Yes. This is a textbook example of how the rich walk while the poor linger in jail.
Mm-hmm.
We should not heed to those who insist that this is justice or necessary for safety. The current bail laws are deeply discriminatory. In our bail report that the Civil Liberties Union produced last year, we found that white New Yorkers are nearly twice as likely as black New Yorkers to be released on the same day that their bail is set. This means that the majority of people incarcerated pretrial in Albany County just in 2010 to 2014 were disproportionately people of color. All of them were legally innocent, not convicted of any crime, yet they faced the risk of losing their jobs, housing, even custody of their children.
That's right.
Because they could not afford to make bail. This is what the new bail law will fix. On January 1st, we're also glad to see changes in our discovery practices go into full effect. New York's criminal discovery practices for decades left defendants in the dark about evidence that might exonerate them, reduce their punishment, or at least give them a fair shot in their defense. But on January 1st, defendants will be able to fairly consider their options, build a legal strategy, and make informed decisions on whether or not they want to forfeit their right to a trial. They will no longer be confronted at trial by surprise witnesses or unanticipated information. Not only will the new discovery law finally bring New York into step with modern court procedures, but it will also bring common sense, fairness to our court procedures. Most of the country, including our neighbors in Massachusetts, practices open discovery. They figured out how to implement it best to protect individuals' access to basic case information. No New Yorker should be forced to make decisions about their rights and their circumstances without knowing basic information about their case. Remember, when you're talking about bail and discovery reform, you're talking about people who have not been convicted of anything. They are supposed to be innocent until proven guilty for a reason. Delaying or tainting these reforms will have consequences. In the name of our human rights, justice, civil rights, and civil liberties, we must move forward with implementation.
Yes!
We happen to be standing here in the city of Troy. Is it not the police?
Come on, Jay.
That we have to worry about when we consider dangerousness.
Come on, Jamaica.
But it's not the DA that's prosecuting the police when they shoot, harm, injure, or murder our people in the streets. So if our district attorneys want to consider dangerousness,
That's right.
Have no further place to look
right.
than the police department that hands them people
yes.
on the daily.
That ain't right.
That's right.
If our DAs want to do the right thing, be sure to prosecute those that are murdering our community members in the name of justice. And to speak more about the harm that's been caused, and to have that message from someone that is living in this community right here in Troy, that's been a part of Justice for Dummy in ensuring that there's a continuing fight going forward that has never dropped, not once. Justice for Dummy has stood strong in the city of Troy. And so I am honored to be able to have Luz Benbow come up and speak. Woo!
Yes. Woo! Thank you. Well, my name is Luz Marquez Benbow, and I'm an adult survivor of childhood sexual abuse, rape, and incest, all between the ages of 7 and 15. And for the last 20 years, I've devoted my life to ending violence against women, not just in the state, but nationally. And I'm here to say that not in my name and not in our name as crime survivors will you continue to hold people who've not even been convicted of a crime in jails just because they're poor. Not in our name and not in my name will you continue to target poor Black and Latino communities who are unable to pay and let free criminals who can pay. Mm-hmm. Not in my name will we continue to talk about ending violence against women and other crimes by thinking that jails and courthouses and law enforcement is actually going to end these crimes. If we are to prevent violence against women and child sexual abuse, then you have to invest in communities right here in Rensselaer County, right here in Troy, New York, and particularly for Black and Latino and poor communities. Right. Not in my name and not in our names as survivors, especially those of us who represent the most harm and the least help, those of us who are Black and Latino and poor communities who are used as pawns to target our communities by holding unfair racist and classist systems by stalling bail reform and speaking out against us. Not in my name and not in our name do I stand here as a member, a founding member of Justice for Dameek and Justice for Essence Thevenin, and will I allow you to harm the Thevenin family and the mom as you claim that you would have handled the murder differently while you were running for your campaign, and now you're not doing anything to prevent the next murder that could happen to police violence and the continued disrespect of our communities. And so not in our name will you continue to do that. Thank you.
And I have as my guest Jamaica Miles, one of the organizers of the event today. And Jamaica, tell us something about this event.
Tonight we came out on Human Rights Day because what better day to celebrate the release of innocent people and their humanity than on Human Rights Day. And these new pre-trial laws that go into effect on January 1st are historic in nature and deserve celebrating.
Now, Jamaica, I know been on television, some of the politicians talking about they're against this, but is this going to be a law that they can't do anything about?
I've got to say, it's already a law, right? This is something that goes into effect on January 1st. And this is something we fought for years. There are advocates and impacted people and allies from across the state. There is no turning back now. We will not be denied.
So with those politicians or legislators who talking against this law, they just spinning their wheels.
They are absolutely not just spinning their wheels. They are preparing for the fear-mongering that we see from other elected officials, those that are not quite so popular in the state of New York. So when Donald Trump stands up there and says, those people and be afraid, we hear some of those same legislators talk about, we don't want to be like Donald Trump. But today, they're standing up and doing the same thing and using the same tactics as a man they say they want nothing to do with.
Now, so come January the 1st, are you going to have another event? You preparing something? Or?
That's actually a great idea. I want to take it back and talk to people and see what they think. Like a big homecoming, a welcome home, if it's not January 1st, but sometime in January to really celebrate the reuniting of people with their communities, families being together, and no longer individuals being in jail just because they can't afford bail.
I hear that, and I know in New York there's a lot of people that are in jail can't get the bail. Because you can't get the bail, that's one thing that there are a lot of people of color make pleas, and even though they're not guilty, right?
Absolutely. The fact that people are railroaded every single day into making plea deals because they're afraid of staying inside those horrible conditions, and let's be real, our jails are not someplace anyone wants to be. People have died in our county jails, and so we need to make sure that we get those people out of there and ensure that they're no longer feeling the pressure to take a plea deal even when they're innocent.
Okay. All right. Thank you, Jamaica.
Thank you.
We just heard various community activists giving their thoughts on the new pretrial reform law at a rally held in front of the Rensselaer County Courthouse in Troy by roaming labor correspondent Willie Terry.
Okay, in segment number 5, in the fall 2019, a network of professors from across the Capital Region came together at the Sanctuary for Independent Media to collaborate around ideas for community-engaged teaching and research, supported by the AAC and us bringing theory to practice multi-institution innovation grant. Say that 5 times fast. These facilities meet regularly as a part of the Campus Community Collaborative, WOOC, correspondent Andrea Cutliffe interviewed Siena College Associate Director Community Engagement Office, Ruth Cassell.
We're here talking with Ruth Cassell, who is the Associate Director at Siena for academic community engagement. Gosh, that sounds great, doesn't it?
Thank you. Hello. Nice to be here.
And how long have you been the associate director of this organization?
A few years as associate director, but I've been doing academic community engagement work for almost 9 years.
Oh, my gosh. It's quite extensive.
Well, yes. I mean, for me, it is.
Well, tell me about it. What kind of projects do you work with the community and with Siena?
So I think that Siena is a great place to be doing this work. We have As part of the Center for Academic Community Engagement, we support community work in a multitude of ways. So we have VISTAs who are out full-time in communities. We work with students who have long-term internships with a lot of different community organizations. And then I work with faculty to design classes and research and to bring interdisciplinary research together. So it's a really multifaceted kind of way of thinking about supporting our community partners.
And what kind of projects are you talking about doing? What kind do your students get engaged with?
I think that I get overwhelmed with that question because there are so many projects going on. I'm always nervous that I'm going to pick the wrong one to talk about. But, you know, some of our Bonners, I'm thinking we're here in Troy right now, and we have Bonners who are at Capital Roots doing really amazing work there, as well as our VISTAs. We have some of our project-based students. They do really interesting work with organizations like the food pantries for the Capital District. And we have students who love to do data work and marketing and communications, and so they're doing work on data for our partners. And so I think it's really cool to watch our students take their disciplines in their classes and be able to apply what they're learning in the community in a way that really builds relationships.
I need an example.
Okay.
How's that?
You know, we've had a bunch of meetings this week, and the one we had yesterday was with the south end of Albany, and we're working with a village and really thinking about community wealth building. And
wealth.
Community wealth building.
Right.
So going beyond kind of bringing services to a community and really thinking about what does it really take to take the people who are most disenfranchised, with people who really need help, and help them to grow their own wealth. How do we anchor wealth in a community? How do we build wealth within the community? And what are the methods for doing it? We talk a little bit about cooperative, worker-owned cooperative models. So if it's a nonprofit, the profit structure go in one way. If it's a entrepreneurial enterprise, it may be owned by somebody outside of the community. When we think about cooperatives, especially when the workers own it, it brings a lot more money back into the community. So we're really thinking about we're working across, it's going to be over a lot of time to think about that.
Well, I mean, it's like keeping local too, isn't it? Mm-hmm. Keeping the money in a local situation.
Correct.
When you're saying you do a cooperative, is that a food? Excuse me, is that a food cooperative?
You know, it started off there, and it still is kind of there. I think we're really thinking about cooperatives broadly, and we would like to have a food cooperative, but like I said, I think we're thinking less about, you know, when you think of Honest Weight, that's a consumer cooperative. Really thinking about the worker, everybody that works there owns.
But what kind of work do they do? What kind of facilities do they supply or do they share?
When it comes to food?
No. Other than food.
Oh, anything. There are worker-owned cooperatives that are healthcare-type cooperatives.
Oh.
There are worker-owned cooperatives that are agricultural. Well, there are producer cooperatives as well that are usually more agricultural. So really, if you think about it, it's just a business model. You can really run any business as a cooperative.
Fascinating. Yeah, that's really great. So do you have a lot of community partners?
Oh, probably a good 30 to 35 at any given time that we work with. That's why I always say, I know I'm going to pick wrong. I'm going to pick the wrong partner talk about.
Give me a general idea of who.
So the land bank we've worked with in the past. We work with numerous homeless shelters. We've worked with the Food Pantry Coalition has been a great partner in the past. We've worked with, who are we currently working with? Wildwood Programs. Wildwood works with people with developmental disabilities.
Oh, yes,
we've been helping them think about kind of an assessment of one of their programs. So we really kind of see what partners need and try to build the resources that they need from there.
That's fantastic. So what are you excited about in the future? What do you think that this whole organization that you're with here today, how it's going to help project you and your ideas forward?
So one of the things that I have started to bring together a lot of our different campuses to talk about how we can do a better job of working together. I think that a lot of community organizations are told that they should be collaborating more, and we as higher ed can be doing a better job of taking that medicine ourselves, of doing it ourselves. And so for the past few years, we have been working with It's 8 or 10 campuses. We get together on about a monthly basis. We run a conference together in May called Engage for Change. And we really started saying, how can we do a better job of working together? This year, we decided to apply for some funding and create a CREST Fellowship, which is a number of faculty who are coming together to design classes and to think about how we can do a better job of collaborating. And so some of us are even talking about how can we collaborate across institutions on our classes. I think it's a great way to start to work with partners in a way that's less taxing. I think partners work with University A and College B, and they're working with all these different campuses, but what if they could work with us as one unit? It would be less trying on their time, I think.
When you say us or working together with us, are you talking about the educators or are you talking about the students as well?
Yes. It's about what if Sage and St. Rose and Siena and New Albany were all talking to each other and we could engage a partner with our students on one collective project.
Wonderful. Do you have an example of one?
You know, we are talking right now about doing some refugee or immigrant-focused work in the spring and thinking about how can we pull together potentially one project, one event that would work with one partner across definitely Sage, probably, I think, St. Rose, Siena, and see where that goes. But really kind of at the start of that conversation. So we'll see where it goes.
Oh, okay. But it sounds like the immigrants are very important. Immigration is a very important issue with you. How would you apply that to a cooperative situation? Are you talking about like manufacturing or building or, I mean, who knows? I mean,
that's very interesting. I hadn't even really thought about whether there is a connection, but I think there really is one. When people want to build a business, they only know one direction. But I think when immigrants come to the United States, whatever the status is, they really are entrepreneurs. They are just in the way they're thinking about coming here, and then that translates into the building of businesses. And so I hadn't really thought about working with refugees and immigrants around more cooperative models of business and whether or not that would really help the community.
There's also certain traditions in many cultures that come with their ancestry, their DNA, who knows, but, you know, things that are natural skills to people that I don't know if we have that here. So maybe that's a nice way of sharing.
Well, one of the things that, one of the readings I'd love to do with people in the spring is a book called Collective Courage. And it talks about the history of African-American collectives and collaboratives and cooperatives. And so it really has been a tradition, even in African-American communities for a very long time, since pre-abolition times. So it really, I think culturally speaking, it fits really well in cultures that have either for their own cultural reasons or for the situations that they're in, meaning they're really put together in, you know, immigrants especially will be in a situation where they are having to pull their resources together in order to really make things work.
And to survive.
And so they're already in this place where I think cooperatives can work well.
That sounds fascinating. I'm really happy to hear that. What do you see? You're a member of this organization that's here today. Are you sticking with it? Is this a new experience for you, or are you nurturing this organization?
Well, I technically created it.
Oh, you did? Well done.
And I am so excited to watch it grow, and I really hope to see it become something that becomes more cross-institutional work in the future, for sure.
Oh, brilliant. Well, congratulations.
Thank you
so much for coming in.
I appreciate it.
That was an interview with Siena College Associate Director of Academic Community Engagement, Ruth Castle, with WOOC correspondent Andrea Cutliff.
Oh, and before I forget, shout out to the best physical therapist in the 518 area, Riddy, for taking care of me so well. All right. That concludes our show. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. Okay, I'm sorry.
And you're Bosch.
Yes, and this is Michelle.
And I'm Michelle. Our engineer tonight is Erica. Remember to tune back in tomorrow and every weekday at 7 a.m., 9 a.m., and 6 p.m. to get your daily dose of local news. You can also get that dose on demand through our Hudson Mohawk Magazine podcast and Facebook page. If you have comments, suggestions, or a tender confession, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org.
And before I close out, once again, we thank and welcome Sheena Gadime, author, playwright, and motivational speaker. It was an awesome interview, and we are so grateful to have you in our midst and part of the 518 area. As a reminder, Hudson Mohawk Radio Network is produced by local volunteers. If you're interested in volunteering with our radio efforts, shoot us an email at info@mediasanctuary.org or just stop by one of our weekly meetings on Monday night, 7:07 p.m., held right here at the Sanctuary for Independent Media. Until next time, folks, I'm H. Bosch Jr. Thank you for tuning in.